Welcome to the program. Sometimes it is through art and literature that we're better able to understand the powerful issues of our time. Perhaps nowhere is this more true than in the Middle East today, where politics, history, and prejudice have blurred the reality of the human condition. A new novel by my guest, Susan Abdullawa, takes a look at these issues through the eyes of Palestinian refugees, often ignored and yet part of a powerful story of survival and a search for a home in the Middle East. It is my pleasure to have Susan Abdullawa here this morning to talk about her new novel, Mornings in Jenin. Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. First of all, talk about your own personal experience.
I was born in Kuwait. My parents were refugees from the Six-Day War. I lived in Jerusalem for about 3 years of my life. Actually, there's a chapter in the book called The Orphanage, and that's really the only chapter in this book that is autobiographical, but that chronicles my 3 years living in Jerusalem. The main character in the book is Amal, and she sort of drifts between Palestine, then Lebanon, and ultimately to the U.S., and in some ways that is reflective of my life, but the characters are very much independent of me otherwise.
But certainly the characters are caught up in the very real history of that part of the world, and in fact the Palestinian family were part of a village that they lost in 1948.
That's correct. It's the village of Anfald, and even though this is a novel, which is fictitious, the characters are fictitious, the historic background is very much historically accurate. It was really important to me that be true. So I did a great deal of research, both in talking to people, stories from my own family, and of course academic research, primarily. And also it was important to me that not just the historic events and historic characters be accurate, but also the location, the local flora, the seasons, and so forth.
Tell us a little bit about Jenin as a place.
Jenin, being in Jenin was one of my primary reasons for wanting to write this book. I was there in 2002 after a massacre had taken place. Israel had bombarded the refugee camp, and they just rained death from the sky and came through with bulldozers and tanks. Ultimately, the camp pretty much lay in ruin 9 days later, with many people crushed inside their homes that were just razed with bulldozers, and the camp was subsequently closed for 2 weeks, and people, reporters were not allowed in, human rights workers were not allowed in, aid workers, and the residents there were left without access to the outside world, access to food or water. And I was working for a drug company at the time, and when the report started to circulate that a massacre had taken place, I just I cut a ticket and went to Jenin. I'd never been to Jenin before. I had no idea, where I was going to go, what I was going to stay with, but I knew that there was more to the story, and I knew that I wanted to bear witness to what was happening. So I did go there, and what I witnessed was really life-changing in many ways, and I really felt an urgency to tell their story, because what subsequently emerged in news reports and various cover-ups at the highest levels were just so dishonorable, so inaccurate, and for those of us who were there and witnessed at least the aftermath of what had happened, it was terribly frustrating and angering. and I really felt an urgency to set the record straight.
Talk a little bit about what you saw when you got there.
Well, there was the first thing that you noticed when you start walking into the camp on the very outskirts was that very pungent smell of death, rotting corpses. And that was it was the first time I had smelled that awful smell. And there were no there was no international aid, and that was something that was very surprising to me. There were a lot of people wearing vests from the Red Crescent, and I realized shortly into it that they were just volunteers who lived in the camp who were helping to dig out bodies from the rubble, and myself and a couple of international volunteers soon started helping them, and I was caught up in helping to dig bodies out of rubble. And you know, there were they were all in various stages of decomposition. Some of them were the bodies of children, old people, young men, young women. It was horrible. It was a real horror. And the people there had lost everything. All of them, all of the residents were living were sleeping, you know, on the floors of the school building and in the mosque. They had lost everything, and yet they were so strong. They were still defiant. They were steadfast. They also were very warm and welcoming. And you know, even though I'm Palestinian, I'm still coming from abroad in the United States. And there were also some international volunteers, Americans, and they were still, you know, they were still able to distinguish between governments and civilians who were there wanting to help them. And it was a very humbling experience to be with people, to be among people like that. And I really fell in love with the people of Jenin.
What was their sense, their understanding of what had happened and why?
You know, it's the what we all understand. I mean, Palestinians, Palestine is being wiped off the map, in essence, by Israel. And the primary reason is, and always has been, because Palestinians are non-Jewish natives of that land. It's pure and simple. And, you know, Israel always commits these horrendous acts against a principally unarmed civilian population with, you know, claims of self-defense. And but the reality is, and we all know the reality, and it's because we're not Jewish. That's the reason. You know, Palestinians have been living under this awful military occupation, where Israel just sort of daily takes a little bit more land, steals more wells, destroys more homes, destroys more lives, destroys schools. Not to mention just destroying, you know, killing people and preventing any emergence of civil infrastructure. It's imperialism by the inch in many ways. Any acts of resistance on the part of Palestinians, whether it's violent resistance or passive resistance, which is what Palestinians have primarily been doing for the past 60 years, Israel crushes it in the most merciless, brutal way, and with no regard for civilian life, with no regard for Palestinian life, period. And in fact, you know, there is a real sense among, the Israeli military, that Palestinians really just aren't quite human. And I guess militaries are that way, you know, universally, and that's what makes destroying other people palatable to human beings. But that is, you know, that's the sense, because when they come through with bulldozers and just have no regard for the fact that there are people inside this home that they're about to level, it can only be interpreted that, you know, they just were not quite human to them.
What keeps the population going?
You know, history is replete with examples of people holding on to their roots, holding steadfast to their humanity, wanting to be recognized as human beings who are worthy of basic human rights, who are no different than the rest of humanity. You know, Palestinians want to live with dignity. They want to inherit their own heritage, their own homeland, their own homes, their own farms, their own orchards and cemeteries where their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents are buried. And you know, those are things that are worth fighting for. They're worth holding on to because you know, what do you have when you lose your identity? I mean, that's even people here in the U.S., you know, they've been in the U.S. for generations and generations, and yet they will identify themselves as, you know, being Italian or Irish or something, and they have never been there. I mean, the sense of identity is at our core as human beings. But to Palestinians, you know, that is coupled with an enormous sense of injustice and sense of being wronged by the world, by the international community, and being treated as subhuman. I mean, we are perpetually asked to relinquish basic human rights that the rest of the world upholds for other people. We are asked to actually negotiate with our oppressors for these basic rights. You know, that sense of injustice is a really powerful motivator to set the record straight, to hold on to what you know is your right, to what you know is your history, is your memories. It's, you know, what your parents and your ancestors had bequeathed to you.
Tell us a little bit about that history and how the people of Jenin, for example, perceive that history.
I don't know what you mean by perceiving history. What we know is our history. We know where we came from. We know the villages where that were taken from us. We know that there are foreigners who were put in our place because these foreigners were deemed to be more human than we are. This is not a perception. This is a reality. Palestinians are a native population who have been ethnically cleansed, forcibly removed from their homes and their villages and their heritage for the simple reason that they aren't Jewish. There's no perception here. This is a reality. And you know, Palestine had... was always a multi-religious, a multicultural, a multi-ethnic country. And, you know, these are ideals that, you know, supposedly the West purports to uphold and value and fight for. And yet this was a reality in Palestine already, this ideal. And the establishment of Israel actually reversed that and has and continues to turn that place of pluralism into a place that is exclusive for Jews and only Jews, and that comes at the terrible detriment of the native non-Jewish population.
What is the dream of most Palestinians in Jenin?
I think that the people of Jenin, like people everywhere in the world, have a vision and an ideal of living in safety, living in dignity, living with prospects of a future, living with hope, the ability to with some predictability to their lives, with some sense of being able to protect their children and provide for their families. That's their dream. I don't think I can, I can really speak for them, but I know that that's what Palestinians, and people everywhere aspire to and dream of and want. But currently that, you know, that isn't the case for Palestinians. There is no sense that they can, that there is anywhere to go, anywhere to hide, that they're able to really protect their children, that their lives, there's any kind of predictability in their lives except that it's unpredictable. You know, no one knows on their way to work if at checkpoint number two, you know, they're going to be turned away, or if they're going to be slapped around, or if they're going to get humiliated, and every day is an adventure. It's and no one really knows, you know, if they're going to get to school or not, if they're going to get to work, if they're going to be able to get back home. If I think some predictability is also some, you know, what they would like to have.
Is there a distinction that's made among the Palestinian people between the Israelis as individuals and the policies of the Israeli government?
You know, I think that varies from one individual to the next in Palestine, and I think it depends on their experience with the occupation and how brutal it has been to them. But certainly there are a lot of Israeli individuals who work with Palestinians, work against the occupation. They work to help restore Palestinian basic rights and to end Israeli colonization and imperialism in Palestine. And the same thing, not just Israelis, but also, you know, internationals from all over the world, and Palestinians are certainly able to make that distinction. And that's, you know, really evident by how welcome they are and how warmly they're received. But, you know, I think, you know, Israelis, by virtue of the fact that they are living in a with privilege that is accorded to them only at the great expense of oppression and ethnic cleansing of another people, I think do bear some responsibility, you know, toward Palestinians, not to be neutral at the very, you know, at the very least, and not to, you know, at that, I mean, that's, and I'm speaking just for myself.
Mm-hmm. You came to the U.S. as a teenager. This has been home for you for a long time. How do you view the U.S.'s role in all of this?
You know, the U.S., without U.S. financial and political cover for Israel, I don't think that we would be in this mess that we're in. I do understand the politics of it. It's and ultimately comes down to you know, an extremely powerful Israeli lobby in Washington, and the fact that our politicians really act on narrow self-interest and rather than the overall best interest of the United States. I don't think it's in the best interest of the United States to alienate so many others around the world, and to be so hypocritical when it comes to Israel, you know, in the face of their massive human rights violations, their massive disregard for international law, and flaunting of various UN decrees and resolutions. For us to continue to stand by that, you know, that sort of awful illegal behavior on the one hand, and then profess to uphold certain ideals that are completely contrary to what Israel does, you know, that weakens us in the eyes of the rest of the world, and it creates a great deal of anti-American sentiment around the world. So I don't think that's in our best interest, but I think it is perpetuated because of the lobby's influence in Washington.
Are these problems that you personally believe have solutions?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I think the solution is there, and it always is, and it's firmly grounded in international law. I very much believe we have universal human rights, and that should be applied to Palestinians, without you know, creative ways to circumvent those, or walk around them and ask Palestinians to give up basic rights in order to accommodate Israel's desire to be exclusively Jewish, to accommodate their desire to take and continue to take the property of non-Jewish natives and give them to foreigners around the world, and or to accommodate Israel's desire to, you know, for every for Jews around the world to have dual citizenship while, you know, Palestinians languish in refugee camps. I do believe that that Israelis who live there, who were born there, that that's their country now, and and that's just a fact. And but they don't have a right to oppress and control the lives of the natives who were already there as well. So I think that the answer is what we here in the U.S. have so mightily fought for, and that is a pluralistic society where we are all equal under the law and we are all equal citizens, treated and treated as equals. And so I guess that would be translated to what has become known as a one-state solution, and that's really what Palestine had always been. It had been a single country where Jews and Christians and Muslims lived in relative harmony, and actually lived in harmony far better than people did in the West at the time, when, you know, Protestants and Catholics couldn't even live next door to each other. So I think that the ideal was already there, and I think that I think returning to that ideal is worth fighting for.
Tell us a little bit about the organization that you founded, Susan, Playgrounds for Palestine.
Playgrounds for Palestine it's an NGO that upholds the right to play for Palestinian kids, and our work is quite simple. We raise money to purchase and build playgrounds for Palestinian kids in the West Bank, Gaza, and in refugee camps elsewhere, like in Lebanon or Syria. We're an all-volunteer group. We've been around since 2001. We've built many playgrounds all around for Palestinian kids. Many of these kids who've never even seen a playground in their life, so they're quite impactful and very meaningful, and represent far more than just a playground to these kids.
Tell us a little bit about the Palestinian children, the children that have grown up, that are growing up in these refugee camps.
You know, the situation is really quite very sad. Breathtakingly sad, actually. In Gaza, for example, 80% of kids now suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. This is particularly after the Operation Cast Lead. I mean, that's a really staggering and shocking proportion of children with having this kind of debilitating psychological disorder that really, you know, in grown men can be very crippling. You know, that value is quite high for children in the West Bank as well. I think it's around 60% there. In the refugee camps outside of Palestine, the kids, you know, that these camps are really not fit for human beings, and they're extremely crowded, very hopeless. The education system is quite bad and lacking in many ways because of they're run by UNRWA, the UN agency that's responsible for Palestinian refugees, as great of a job as UNRWA is doing, they are, you know, extremely underfunded, and I think that they do the best that they can with what they have, but it's still very inadequate. So, you know, in some ways, you know, you combine this poverty with, you know, this intentional destruction of schools, these crippling psychological disorders, the persistent bombing, the lack of sense of safety, and you really have something of a generation that's lost or is being lost. And there are, you know, organizations like Playgrounds for Palestine and hundreds of others, really, we're always just scrambling, trying to restore some sense of normalcy. But it's really a daunting task in the face of what Israel will do in a day or a week with the most modern, mechanized, and technological weaponry available to man.
As you've gone around in the U.S., telling this story, talking about mornings in Jenin, talk a little bit about the reaction that you've heard.
You know, the reaction from readers has been very heartening. It's been wonderful, in fact. A lot of readers have written to me saying that, you know, the book was deeply affecting to them, and some readers have actually said that, you know, I've tried to understand this conflict for years, and I've tried to, you know, to read about it, and it never seemed to make sense. I could never understand why, you know, Arabs are so upset with us here in the U.S., but I finally get it reading your book, and I think that's really that's the power of literature. To bring to make history human, to let us see world events through the eyes of human beings. I think it has the power to break down barriers between people. I think it has the power to remind us all of our common humanity. And I think that has really been the overwhelming reaction from readers. There's certainly been people who, you know, who are on the opposite side of this political conflict and who were quite angry about it and didn't like that Israel was painted in not so good light. But you know, and also interestingly, some people felt like this book is not even-handed, and those were the words that are actually used. But you know, a novel is not meant to be. Even-handed. It's a story, and it's told through a perspective. It's told through the eyes of the characters, and whatever their perspective might be, is what comes out. So it's interesting some people would expect that these Palestinians who've lived under really horrendous oppression and an awful history and injustice against them should somehow kind of put their own pain aside and try to see the world through the eyes of their oppressors. It's kind of absurd. But
Susan Abelhawa, her book is Mornings in Jenin. It is just out in paperback from Bloomsbury. Susan, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jeff.